When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Welcome to the second episode of a conversational spin-off season of Cry Like a Boy, a Euronews original podcast that explores how the pressure to be a man can harm families and societies. I am Mampea Jiao. Traveling to 5 African countries, Cry Like a Boy tells stories of men who dare to rethink their masculinity and defy centuries-old stereotypes. In our previous episodes, we spoke to Adam Adjian, former UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, about the impact such a violent act as genocide could have on men, women, communities, or male victims of rape. Today, we have a different guest, George M. Johnson, the author of All Boys Aren't Blue, and we are talking about a whole different subject and a different kind of violence and how to deal with it as a queer black person. From their memories of getting their teeth kicked out by bullies at age 5, to flea marketing with their loving grandmother, to their first sexual relationships, activist George M. Johnson speaks up about their experiences. They explore queer sexuality and encourage black queer people to stand up for their identity. Hi, George, and welcome to the show. So the first question is, why did you feel the need to write All Boys Aren't Blue? Why was it important for you?
It was important for me to write All Boys Aren't Blue because for so long in my life and in the life of many other LGBTQ people, we hadn't been seen or represented, not just in publishing, but in media, television, film. Across the board, you don't have a whole lot of stories about LGBTQ people, specifically Black LGBTQ people. I felt we had gotten to a point in time where people needed to learn more about the people who exist with them. Black queer people have always existed from the beginning of time, whether you look at ancient Egypt. We've been here at every iteration point, even if our story hasn't really been told. Or hasn't been told properly in many cases, or told absent the fact that we were LGBTQ people when they talked about some of the things that we may have contributed to society. And so I felt it was really necessary at this point to put a truthful story out about what my experience was as a young queer boy. And I thought it was even more necessary to make sure that the book was specifically geared towards young adults who often have to navigate school systems and entities and just society where they don't feel seen or heard and don't have the resources and education to understand what may be going on with them. And so, that was pretty much my reasoning for knowing that it was time to write a book like this to shift the narrative on what the existence of Black queer people has always been.
In your book, you open up about your feelings and intimate experiences. Why is it so important for you to show your vulnerability so openly?
I mean, for me, it was necessary to be vulnerable and transparent because anything that I kept out of the book only further hindered the people who really needed to read the book and understand and learn not just about society and community, but also learn about themselves, especially if they were also growing up as queer people who were looking for some type of resource or looking for some type of understanding or looking for some type of healing. So for me, being vulnerable and being transparent, that was the only option. I think the ultimate goal, though, is for heterosexual people, queer people, people who are the guardians of queer people, people who are friends of queer people, to understand what our story is too, to understand that we don't exist in a bubble outside of community, that we are also a part of community, and that if we have issues, even if they are specific queer issues, because we are Black people, that those queer issues are also Black issues too. I think it's about making sure that people understand that as Black queer people, we don't separate our Blackness from our queerness. We are both at the same time. The ultimate goal of the book was to show that we don't just get to exist as this identity or this identity, that when I enter spaces, pretty quickly, people realize I am a Black queer person. And because they realize that, all of my privileges from the way I look to my oppressions because of my sexuality all play a role in how people are going to treat me. And so, I think that was really the reason for my vulnerability and transparency. But I don't think the end goal of society is to make people necessarily more vulnerable or transparent, but it is to make people more aware, to make people more acknowledging that people exist outside of the hetero norms in society. And to make people know that, like, you know, we deserve the same type of equity, we deserve the same type of rights, we deserve the same type of things that any other human being deserves, regardless of what our sexuality or our gender is.
I think now on TV and in pop culture, we have more representation of queer people and transgender people as well. Do you feel that that is true?
I mean, one, yes, we do have more visibility. Yes, we do have more representation. No, we still do not have enough visibility. No, we certainly still do not have enough representation. I can't really gauge whether it's helping yet, especially as we watch multiple states try to ban trans kids specifically from healthcare, try to ban trans people from healthcare, as we watch rollbacks of protections for LGBTQ people across the country. So it's not necessarily that our visibility is then creating more normalcy in community, is creating a more accepting, a more acknowledging society, so to speak. I do think it has had its benefits. We have seen movement, we have seen changes, we have seen gay student, you know, alliances formed at high schools, and we've seen a lot of forward moving things, and we've seen a movement towards people, you know, using proper pronouns. We've seen a movement just towards a lot of promising things, but I wouldn't say we're anywhere near where we need to be in terms of queer people feeling safe in society. That's still the top issue for many people, is the fact that despite the amount of visibility we have, despite the amount of representation we have, despite the fact that we are, you know, in the workplace and we are in organizations with heterosexual people and we are in all of these spaces with them, we still don't have the safety, and we still don't have enough people who have come to a common understanding of our existence and the fact that we deserve to not just exist, but deserve every right to have the same benefits and privileges in society as anyone else. It's still going to take a lot more heterosexual people leading and advocating, because clearly queer people can't make that happen on their own. But, you know, I would say, you know, we've had some steps forward in some places while still having some steps back in some places. And so the fight just continues for us, you know, until we can actually get to a place where we're not just existing in community, but, you know, we are safe and we actually have the space to thrive in community.
Do you think people expect you to be a certain way just because you identify as queer?
I don't know if people expect me to be a certain way because I identify as queer. I mean, I think that the stereotype of who queer people are that's been placed into media is, you know, more flamboyant, I guess more like sexually deviant, more like there are certain stereotypes clearly that have been placed out there. I think for us, though, it's like, yeah, we do have flamboyant gays and we have this type of gay, and we have reserved gays, and we have chill gays, and we have this type of queer, and we have that type of queer. I mean, I just think that we just haven't, again, I think it goes back more to a visibility and representation issue where we haven't had enough stories of what the totality of our community even looks like. You know, the stereotyping of us is more of a media portrayal of us than anything that we've done or that, you know, that we're doing. And yeah, of course, the stereotypes still exist. I mean, but I think that when you have shows like Pose, you know, breaking down a barrier, just like you got RuPaul's Drag Race, which shows a different side of queerness and queer people. I mean, I think we are seeing, you know, across the board where you're seeing what different queer experiences look like. With my book, with my dramatic reading, For All Boys Aren't Blue, like, I mean, there's texts and works and bodies of work that are now showcasing the diversity of our community. Again, a diversity that has always existed pre-colonization. But the stereotypes, they're still there for some. I mean, it just is what it is. Like, stereotyping is a thing that's been around for Black folks, it's been around for queer folks, it's been around for a lot of different demographics of people. So, you know, yeah, we still have our stereotypes of what people assume we are and then are shocked by when, you know, I thought you would be like this. But that's because the only representation or the only thing that they've ever seen is that thing. So they just assume it, you know, they cast a wide stroke across a community thinking that everybody acts the same way. But, you know, we're extremely diversified. And I think we are seeing more and more images of the diversity that we have within community, but it's still going to take a very long time to break the stereotypes, because stereotypes have been here much longer than the diversity has been here of our community being shown. So
we're talking about the community, but also when it comes to family, for example, you mentioned a lot of love and support that your family embraced you with. Was that enough to make you feel safe as a queer person?
No, I didn't only live with my family. I still had to go out into society. So, I mean, you can be loved at home and hated in your community. So, I mean, that's never enough. And I always say love is never enough. You have to also, as far as society and community is concerned, you know, there has to be safety. And there has to be other things and other benefits, you know, and other privileges and accesses and resources that we should have that we are still denied because we are queer people. And so, you know, being loved at home was a benefit for me because I always had safety at home, but I still had to go out into the real world where my mother and my father weren't there with me all the time. My brothers weren't there with me all the time. And my cousins weren't there with me all the time. And I had to fend for myself against racism. I fend for myself against homophobia. That was still occurring to me while I was in high school and while I was in college. And so, yeah, you know, having the safety of my family was a true benefit because there are so many queer people who don't even have that as their baseline. But even with that as my baseline, it didn't stop the fact that I still had to exist in a society where my family couldn't always protect me.
After publishing the book, how has your life changed?
I mean, my life has changed. I've become a lot more visible, you know, social media-wise, community-wise, world-wise. My story has, you know, is being developed into a television show. It's been translated into multiple languages. It has a dramatic reading that's at film festivals all across the country and now going international. My life has significantly changed in terms of how I've become someone with a voice to help so many others. My words have helped so many others. My words have healed a lot of people. My words have brought a lot of people to understandings of queer people that they never had before. I sometimes have to sit back and, you know, realize like and be grateful to, you know, the universe for, you know, choosing me to tell this story. But sometimes it is a lot of weight on my shoulders to continue to tell the story and continue to be the face of this particular story. Like I said, a story that millions of us have. I'm just one of the first people to be allowed to tell it in this way. And so, yeah, you know, it's extremely life-changing to be the person who All Boys Aren't Blue is about, and have had, you know, so many tens of thousands of people across the world, you know, reading my story and seeing my story and all of those things, because people then know you before you know them. And so it does, it creates an interesting space with the visibility and everything. But, you know, I'm fortunate to have it. I'm fortunate to have the platform to tell this story. And I'm fortunate that my words will exist, you know, in the world and continue to help people for years to come.
You also said that this was hard for you. Why exactly was this hard for you?
Anytime you look at visibility, the more your visibility grows, you know, that means there are more eyes on you for every single thing that you do. There are more people watching you for every single thing that you do. When you go out, especially me, when I go out to LGBTQ events or specific spaces, you know, people are coming up to you. People want to talk to you. People want to tell you about their traumas because your book helped them. So it's a lot to take on as the one person who wrote this book that has helped thousands of others. You know, I'm just one person, but I get, you know, direct messages, emails of people's traumatic, very traumatic stories. And, you know, they tell me that my book helped them, but it doesn't alleviate the fact that they still pour a lot of their trauma, you know, into my space. And so it can be hard at times because you're realizing that there are still a lot of hurt people in this world, a lot of broken people in this world. And even though my book is doing that work to help so many, it doesn't negate the fact that I still know that I still have a lot more work to do and that I still carry the burden of speaking for so many people who still feel like they don't have a voice in this world.
Now, my last question is a little bit of a philosophical question. So in your book, you make a very interesting reflection on how gender roles mark our existence from the moment we see them in an ultrasound scan. In many cases, it means, you know, before birth. So how do you imagine a world in which parents would raise their children without the expectation of them being a boy or a girl?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, if you removed boy and girl and you just said that you had a baby that was born with this, you know, this anatomy, it pretty much alleviates all of that. I think the problem is we have made anatomy equal male, female, and then we have made male, female equal man, woman, or boy, girl. And so that's really what the actual issue is, because a person's genitalia does not define them. Like, a person's genitalia isn't going to tell you what your child is going to act like and what innately is going to be your child's emotion and what innately is going to be the things that your child is going to gravitate to. And realistically, it's more of a denial of what they may be interested in or gravitate to, right? I mean, because once a baby that is born with a vagina is deemed a girl, if at 5 years old she wants to play football, you already have people stopping her from playing football. If at 5 years old she wants to wear jeans instead of wearing dresses, you already have people shaming her and shunning her because she is a girl and she's supposed to wear dresses. And that was all just based on the fact of what her genitalia was. Nothing else. Not about who she is, not about what her spirit is, not about what innately she gravitated to. It was simply because your genitalia is this, so you have to act like this. And so I need to imagine a society where parents are less concerned about their child being a thing because of their genitalia and more concerned about, okay, my child has this genitalia. However, in nurturing my child, I'm seeing that my child likes Barbies. And even though society is saying boys can't like Barbies, my child is innately liking Barbies and is innately liking makeup and innately liking to do hair and innately liking to do these things. And I'm going to nurture that, because my child's genitalia it should not matter that much to then dictate before birth what path they should be taking in life and why they should have to fight society against that path simply because a check mark was marked on their birth certificate because of their genitalia.
This was a special spin-off episode of Cry Like a Boy. I'm your host, Mafea Diao. Thank you for listening. I would like to thank again our special guests, George M. Johnson, activist, author of All Boys Aren't Blue, an autobiographical novel that urges Black queer persons to stand up for their identity. It's a really great book, so if you're interested in the topic, we definitely recommend that you read it. Listen to Cry Like a Boy on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We work hard to produce the episodes, so if you like the show, please help us spread the word, give us a 5-star rating, or leave a comment. Follow us on Twitter. At Euronews is our Twitter handle, and we are at euronews.tv on Instagram. Also, share with us your own stories of how you changed and challenge your view on what it means to be a man using the hashtag #CryLikeAboy. If you're a French speaker, this podcast is also available in French. Dans la tête des hommes is the name of the podcast series. For more information on Cry Like a Boy, a Euronews original series and podcast, go to euronews.com to find opinion pieces, videos, and articles on the topic. This show was produced by me, Mampeya Diao, Naira Davlashian, and Marta Rodriguez Martinez. Music by Gabriel Dalmaso.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.